to number 11748, Reel 2.
Colonel Ismail Khan, Reel 2. What happened to the senior officers?
Well, they were transferred. Nobody else was cashiered. And General Timaya, you all know, he ended up by becoming Chief of Staff of the Indian Army, Commander-in-Chief of the Indian Army, after the partition of India, after General, after another general from South India, I just can't recall his name right now. And Karyapa, General Karyapa, was the first Indian officer to become the Chief of Staff of the Indian Army in 1947, after General Sir Rob Lockhart, I think, yes? And then following that, General Timaya was Command Chief of the Army in 1948. And in 1948, November, I was commanding a bunch of Gilgit scout irregulars, and I had to face General Timaya's onslaught in November 1948. And General Timaya, General Majid, later retired General Azam, they were transferred, but there were nothing against him. But this Zahiruddin was cashiered. Zahiruddin is a story by itself, which I wouldn't like to place here. He became quite rather famous later on. But I won't mention right now because it doesn't have any bearing on this. So this mutiny, we all discovered, but nobody mentioned it, nobody talked about it. It was just a passing matter. By this time, we had arrived in Malaya in November 1940 with our brigade, 8th Indian Brigade, with 2nd Baluch, my battalion, with 3rd 17 Dogras, Dogra Regiment, completely Hindu battalion, and 2nd 18th Garhwal Regiment, 2nd 12th Funday Force Regiment, and 1st Battalion 13th Funday Force Rifles, the Cookies. We arrived in Malaya and we went to Kota Bharu after a 2-week stay in Singapore. And at that time, in Malaya, two divisions were formed. First was 11th Indian Division, commanded by Major General Murray Loyne, was given the task of defending the west coast of Malaya with an eye towards the northeast for the Margui Archipelago, with a place called Kro south of it, and the road leading up to Penang through a place called Jersey. And the 9th Indian Division, under Major General Bastow, was formed to defend the east coast, comprising of 8th Indian Brigade, commanded by Brigadier B.W. Key, DSO MC, and the division commander was Major General Bastow. And it was the 9th Indian Division headquarters was in Kuala Lumpur, practically the center of Malaya, a little south of it. And the 11th Indian Division headquarters were somewhere in Penang or on the mainland. I'm not quite sure. These two divisions formed the 3rd Indian Corps under the command of Lieutenant General Heath, called Piggy Heath, was nicknamed Piggy Heath. He had a kind of a gamey arm, you know, shorter arm than the right arm than the left. But tremendous soldier. He commanded the 5th Indian Division in Karen and Eritrea very successfully against the Italians. And there he commanded them very well. So incidentally, 6th Royal Battalion, 13th Funday Force Rifles, and a couple of other Indian battalions, and East Yorks and Yorkshire Regiment, they were all there under his command. When he arrived back from Eritrea's successful campaign, he was given the command of this 3rd Indian Corps. And an amusing story, when he came to visit us first, he gave us a talk about the fighting in Karen and Eritrea, General Piggy Heath. His amusing story I remember to this day, that he said that the Pathan troops used to abuse and shout when they went into attack. Very blasphemous lot they were, the Pathan Muslims. The Punjabi Muslims used to shout, Ya Ali, taking the name of the Prophet son-in-law, who was a great soldier. And always the soldier who is fighting calls upon him to help him in battle. Ya Ali. Ya Haider, Ya Ali. And the Dogra troops and Hindu troops used to shout, Jai Ram Jiki. Jai Ram Jiki. And the Sikh troops used to shout, Why Guruji Di Fateh. So the East Yorks who were going to attack next morning, they thought they must have a, you know, some kind of a war cry. All these chaps are shouting some outlandish language and they don't understand a thing. So they couldn't decide upon a war cry, the East Yorks. And when they went in the morning into attack, there was very banner in their war cry, and they used a four-letter word. And they went up using that word, and you know, in their local thing, I won't mention it here. Should I? No, no.
Why not?
They said when East Yorks went to attack, General Piggy, he said that they said they went with a cry called "fuck, fuck, fuck," you know, throughout. So this showed the sense of humor of our corps commander, and we all took to him. For example, when he came to visit a detachment camp of ours, 2nd Battalion, 10th Baruj Regiment, detachment camp, where I was quartermaster and adjutant of the detachment and company officer, C Company. C Company was a Dogra company, Hindu company in our battalion. When he came to visit us, I had to give a demonstration of firing a 2-inch mortar, which we had just received, and a Tommy gun, which was a forerunner of the Sten gun later. Tommy gun was the one which was used by the American gangsters, like Dellinger and things like that. So I had to give a demonstration. When they arrived in the morning to inspect it, there was another story which I was thinking of, and there was the story was against me, but nobody knew except me and a few officers. When they arrived in the morning, I was presented, along with other officers. There was a young British captain, red-haired captain, from his name was Lamb, and I should call him Charles Lamb. He was a staff officer with an Indian State Force battalion from Mysore State Forces in the south of India. He was a captain. I was a second lieutenant. So as I was introduced, Charles Lamb was introduced to him. He said, how much service have you got? So Charles Lamb said, 3 months service. And he was a captain. When he was introduced to me next after him, said, Second Lieutenant Ismail Khan. So Piggy Heath asked me, how much service have you got? So I said, 9 months service. So he took his 3 fingers and put it on the shoulder of young Lamb and said, 3 months service and you are a captain. And there's an old warrior with 9 months service is still a second lieutenant. There's something must be wrong with the bloody rank structure. Everybody laughed and they went by. My demonstration was very successful. I mean, both the things. Except that one of our Viceroy commissioned officers, a Punjabi Muslim called Muhammad Khan, he was giving a demonstration under the watchful eye of the corps commander, and the DIF commander, and the brigade commander, and the battalion commander, about the use of Molotov cocktails. And he said he was giving a talk to the soldiers in Urdu, and he was showing a bottle, the Molotov cocktail, which we had manufactured ourselves. And he said, this is called the Molotov cock. So that brought out laughter from everybody. Anyhow, then, the other amusing incident was that I had to give them breakfast to all this galaxy of high-grade staff ranks. My advisor was a young Australian called Rafferty from the coal storage in Kota Bharu. So he gave me the menu for the breakfast. Menu consisted of orange juice from California, tinned, sun-kissed oranges from California. I remember the price of 50 cents each, Malayan cents, against Malayan dollar, half a Malayan dollar, and haddock, and fried eggs, and bacon. Though I didn't eat bacon, but I had to produce it because there's a lot of British officers, and so on and so forth. When this repast was produced in front of this galaxy of senior ranks, they looked at each other and said, who's paying for all this? Now, mine was a detachment camp with three of us members of the mess. So, C was embarrassed. Our Sankamon was embarrassed. So, finally, the brigadier said, all right, we'll pay for it. So, they all took out money from their pockets, three straight dollar notes, $3 each, and placed it on the table. And the brigadier told our CO, John, who's paying for this? So he said, all right, will you check up? Such grand hospitality must be discouraged. And this was specially in view of the book which I read by Field Marshal Alan Brooke, the Chief of Imperial General Staff later, that his disparaging remarks about the French army commanders just before the debacle in France in 1939-40. That the French were more concerned with their gourmet habits rather than fighting. And his disparaging remarks about this had not entered my mind because I hadn't read his book. So now I can see that Piggy Heath and Billy Key and Bostow must have been furious at this. But nobody ticked me off really, seriously. Except that later the battalion headquarter mess, which was 35 miles away, controlled my heating, our eating bills, something like that in the mess. So there were the general conditions there. Then the whole concept of the defense of Malaya, as everybody must have read many books since then, was based on air defense. The whole concept of Malaya command was, the defense of Malaya was, by then, in 1939-40, by a ring of air bases around Malaysia and within Malaysia, ring of air bases. While Singapore had air bases, small air bases, like Seletar, like Tengah, and things like that, but the major defense effort was on the Navy, from mid-1920s, practically. They had erroneously thought that any attack on Singapore would be made by sea on the island of Singapore, where the British had built a tremendous naval base. Developed, mind you, throughout the years, from mid-20s onwards, till 1940. Their huge guns, called big bursas, were 30 miles range, and they were pointing to the sea. By 1940, naval base was very well defended with these big bursa guns and anti-aircraft guns, but with no ships, no naval flotillas were there. Air Marshal Brooke Popham was overall commander. He was an Air Force Air Marshal, but with no Air Force to command. There were very, very small elements of Wapitis carrying these torpedoes. Later on, 1941, there were Blenheim bombers, and there were these and some other bomber and some Hurricane squadrons. But not a single air base was really properly equipped with aircraft. So that was the time. And that's why the army effort was not given much boost, except the 11 div on the west coast and 9 div on the east coast. Artillery element was also to my mind, as I remember, as I recall, was inadequate. My later studies of the book, of the books which I read even as late as about 10 years ago, less than 10, a book written by Brigadier Kirby, a British officer, on the defense of Malaya. In that book I read, I haven't got the book now because the Malaysian ambassador borrowed it from me in Islamabad about a few years ago, about 6 or 8 years ago. He never gave it back to me. Brigadier Kirby wrote that there was an appreciation written on the defense of Malaya in 1925. And there it was appreciated that the Japanese will not attack Singapore, frontal assault, but they'll come through the northeast coast and come down to the west coast. And they gave battle by battle, which took place in 1941. The battle in Jersey, the battle on Slim River, the battle in Moore, and so on and so forth. This is all mentioned in that book. And then there was another appreciation written in 1937. And General Percival, who was later the GOC in chief of Malaya in 1940, later part of 1941 before the Jap attack. And in 1937, he was a full colonel in the Malaya command. He had read their appreciation under his direction was also on, the same lines. But when he came again in 1941 to command the Malayan defenses, strange enough, he had asked for a new appreciation. And the new appreciation, I don't know what it was, really, because I saw no changes by the time the Japs attacked to the appreciation, which was written in 1925 and later in 1937, according to Brigadier Kirby's book. And the Japs attacked exactly simultaneously with Pearl Harbor. They attacked the Marguerite Archipelago. The name of the place, I think, is Patani, Sungi. From there, they trickled down to Crow, a place called Crow, north of Jitra, in the narrow strip between Thailand and Malaya. And from there they came unopposed to a bridge, which was being defended by, I think it was 3rd 16th Punjab Regiment, commanded by Colonel Muirhead, great soldier Muirhead. And the company commander, young company commander, was a cadet with me, but he was a regular cadet, just passed out before me. I mean, his commission was before me. Zarif. Zarif's company was given to defend that bridge on Crow. And he took the Japanese on his business in the middle of the bridge, and there was a terrific battle ensued. He withdrew, but inflicting a lot of casualties on the Japanese. Finally, when the Japs attacked, he withdrew, and the major brunt of the battle was taken by the 11th Indian Div at a place called Jersey, where the Japanese first breakthrough took place within a matter of 24-48 hours. From then onwards, the battle took the same shape which was given in Brigadier Kirby's book, which was written about mid-20s. Written much later, but he had mentioned the appreciation which was given in about 1925. While on the east coast, in Kodabaru, the northeast coast of Malaya, the Japanese attacked Kodabaru simultaneously with their chrysanthemum division. Transport ships escorted by cruisers and destroyers were sighted off the coast of Kodabaru, but lost our Air Force reconnaissance by the Royal Australian Air Force based in Kodabaru aerodrome. They lost sight of them about 24 hours before their attack, or 12 hours before their attack, or the night before. By then, I was sent to the brigade headquarters and the battalion liaison officers with headquarters. I arrived there 2 days before the Japanese attacked, 5th, I think, of December. I was slightly nervous because leaving my battalion, going to a strange headquarters, which I didn't like in those days, but my love for Billy Key made it easier for me. And Billy Key took me on a trip to the battalions the next day. It was on the night of 7th and 8th December, at about 12 o'clock, when we heard the boom of the guns, and we woke up to the fact that the Japanese have attacked the Saba Beach, which was held by the Dogra Battalion, 3rd Battalion, 3rd 17th Dogra Regiment, which were nearest to the Kodabaru Aerodrome. There the battle was taking place, and I was sent, because one officer was sent to go check up on the fighting on the beach. He was from our battalion called Mike Tice. Well, the poor devil couldn't find his way through somehow, and he came back. So brigade commander was very keen to find out as to what was the condition of the battle in the beaches. So I volunteered to go because I knew the area. So he said to go, but be very careful. See the progress of the battle and come back and report. Come back and report. So I took up my motorcycle. It was raining. It had been raining for many days. Roads were muddy. Through the jungle, I knew my way through a track. I stopped my motorbike there and crossed a bridge over a very bad stream infested with all kinds of reptiles, like crocodiles and things like that. So it was about a few inches wide plank of wood. The Malays used to walk with their feet splayed along it, but I, with my ammunition boots, I couldn't dare in the pitch darkness to go. So I sat on it astride and pulled myself with my hands slowly forward. I got there to the Saba Beach. I got to the 3rd 17 Dogra Battalion headquarters. Their CO, called Lieutenant Colonel Peter Haynes, was away on duty somewhere, I don't know, to India or someplace. The second command, called Major Foster, was commanding the battalion. He was a thin, wiry man. My recollection of him was that when the brigade commander, Brigadier Billy Key, at the first lunch party, I was a guest in his house in end of August 1940, and Major Foster was there too. I remember him to this day at the lunch. Anyhow, so when I went and saw him, he was wounded through his right shoulder and sitting against a palm tree. By then the light was seen, I could see hundreds of Japanese lying dead on the beaches. No more boats were coming even. I didn't see any more boats coming. But the Japs had infiltrated right and left of the Saba Beach everywhere. So Major Foster told me that, well, this is it. The Japs have gone through. They have moved forward inland. And his battalion is practically wiped out. There was an Indian officer who was a cadet when I was there doing my training in Dehradun Indian Military Academy, called Naveen Chandra. And Major Foster told me that Naveen Chandra was going into a counterattack with his two sections on the beach. He, in order to recapture a pillbox, as he was moving with his two sections, he was shot in the ear to the ear. And he was dead. Similarly, when he told me that many other officers were killed and wounded and so on and so forth, so I said, all right, then I must go back and report the matter to the brigade commander. By then it was sun had risen. So I tracked back. As I crossed this little plank bridge, I found a Jap soldier standing in front of me without his little rubber boots with his split toe. Without his putties, the trousers were hanging on his feet. And he had lost his steel helmet, but his rifle was there in his hand. And around his belt, there were a few pouches of ammunition and a few grenades. So I looked at him, and without hesitation, I walked towards him. Called, hey, hey, this is this. The moment he saw me, within a few yards, it was a... But then the forest had thinned out. He saw me, he dropped his rifle and put his hands up. So I walked to him, towards him, picked up his rifle. So I looked at him up and down. He didn't say a word of English. I didn't know a word of Japanese. So I said, let's go. So I put him in front of me. I carried his rifle in my left hand, my pistol in the right, and marched him up.
Where was this?
Behind the beaches, behind the Saba beach. Behind the Saba beach in Kodabaru, the beach which was held by 3rd 17 Dogras. The battalion was practically wiped out that day. So I moved him up to my motorbike. I gave him his rifle. He slung it over his shoulder. Such was the innocence of youth that I thought he was as safe as a babe in arms. He put his rifle, he slung it across his shoulders. I made him sit pillion, and I drove him up to the brigade headquarters. On the way, some incredulous eyes were watching me, Indian soldiers, some British officers, and I was waving at them with my hands, jab, 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 and I was going around laughing away like hell. I'd forgotten Major Preston was being wounded. I'd forgotten about the... But such was the confidence of youth. When I entered the brigade headquarters, which was in the Malay school in Kodabaru, our war station, I said, hey, war, I brought you a jab. I took him to the brigade headquarters office, where I met Richard Dent, our brigade major. He was from 2nd, 12th Front of Force Regiment. He said, what the hell are you doing? I said, I brought you a jab. He said, my God, where the hell did you get him? I said, I met him on the way back from the beach. And I said, hey, and he said, oh, and I said, come along, and he came with me. So the jab is standing there. So he called for his sentry to come in, take his rifle away from him, and take his belt, which has still had grenades. And he went in and told the brigade commander. The brigade commander called me and said, what is it? I said, sir, I go, it's a jolly good thing. How did you get it? So I told the story in his thing. I said, he looked at me and I looked at him and I said, hey, and he said, oh, and I said, come along, and I brought him. He said, it was a jolly good effort, very good. So he said, get somebody who knows Japanese to question him. So they decided upon a chap called Rollins. He was a senior civil servant, British civil servant in Kodabaru, and he was a Japanese expert. So, by the time he came, he was in his tennis shorts, a tennis shirt, which today they call t-shirts and whatnot. He had freshly had a shower, his hair was still wet, but I could see his knees were trembling. He was a big, tall chap, and a polo player with whom I had played a little amount of polo in Kodabaru. So he questioned the chap. And during the question, the Jap told that he belonged to the Chrysanthemum Division. And he had in his pocket some Malay stray dollars and a map of Malaya and Singapore, and pictures of his family, and plus certain prophylactics for his sexual use if he